Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Dom Harvey Podcast, proudly sponsored by Radix and Generate. Coming up, Rick Sollizzo.
The first episode of Sports Cafe, it was so bad. I walked off the set and the crew wouldn't look at me. No one would look at me except we had this one producer working with us, Alan Thurston, who was a genius. And he looked at me and he gave me the thumbs up and he said it was shit, but there's something there. So you've got to start. I mean, that's the easiest piece of advice. You just got to start.
Yeah, the man, the myth, the legend, Rick Sollizzo. More about him in a moment, but first, a shout out to my sponsors who have made this episode possible, Generate and Radix. Generate is an award-winning KiwiSaver provider with a track record of chart-topping long-term performance. If you want to make sure you're making the most of your KiwiSaver account, talk to an advisor now. Head to generatekiwisaver.co.nz/get advice. Switching is a piece of cake. You think it's going to be hard. It's so simple. I changed providers when Generate started supporting the podcast, and it legitimately could not have been easier. If you do reach out, tell them I sent you. That website again, generatekiwisaver.co.nz/get advice. Also, a huge thanks to the legends at Radix. Radix is a Waikato-based nutrition company taking on the world. Elite athletes have been pounding their products since ages ago, but the truth is, each and every one of us can improve our health by eating more Radix products. Their range of freeze-dried breakfasts are impossibly good in terms of the taste, the texture, simplicity, and the nutritional punch they pack. And I know I'm paid to say these things, but I genuinely believe it. Radix products are the best, world class. Check them out for yourself, radixnutrition.co.nz. Radix is spelled R-A-D-I-X, radixnutrition.co.nz. All right, now to this week's episode, Rick Sollizzo. New Zealand sports broadcasting royalty. This guy's CV is too long to list in full, but a few highlights. He became the All Blacks' very first media liaison officer in the early 90s and was part of the All Blacks setup during the chaos of Jonah Mania in 1995. He created and hosted the cult TV show Sports Cafe, which ran for 11 years, then launched The Crowd Goes Wild, which I think has been going for like 16, 17 years now and showing no sign of slowing up. Until recently, Rick has been living and working in New York, so connecting with him at my home studio was a real treat. We cover a lot of ground in this conversation. Rick Sollizzo is a world-class storyteller with stories that are truly world-class, so I hope you guys enjoy this one as much as I did. All right, let's get into it. Rick Sollizzo on the Dom Harvey Podcast.
Welcome to your spare room. But these are not real bricks.
No, that's wall. Oh, ruin the illusion.
Oh shit!
No, it's wallpaper. No, it's coming along good. Hey, thanks so much, mate. You're like a dream guest.
So, that's seeing your name in lights, isn't it? Yeah. That's good. I like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's no TV person that's ever offered me any sort of work. So, no. Buy a couple of cameras now. Get your own neon
exactly.
sign. Boom.
That's the way.
You're in business. So how are you? How are you today?
I'm good. I got back, so I've been away overseas for about 4 years, 3.5, 4 years, and then did the World Cup, and then came back 1st of November, I think. So yeah, it's been nice being back in New Zealand, actually. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, we'll get to the World Cup later on and your involvement in that. But yeah, while I was doing my notes yesterday, it's like, oh, you've been at two World Cup finals.
I've
maybe you're a bad luck charm.
Yeah. No, I've been to... The only World Cup I haven't been to was the Japanese one.
Right. No, but I mean in terms of official involvement, you were 95.
Oh, yeah, 95, yeah. That was my fault. And it must have been my fault this last one as well.
Oh, yeah, 95, that was the food poisoning one, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, with Susie the waitress. Yeah. Okay, so so you've been in New York the last 4 years working with rugby over there.
Yep.
And you move from New York to Tairua, and Tairua, like the landmass of that place, is probably like half of Central Park.
So there is less people live in Tairua than live in my apartment block in New York. So, yeah, it was quite a shock, but I loved it. I love being in Tairua, and people are amazing. And, you know, if you told an American, if you took Tairua and designed it, and said to an American, this is where you could live, they'd think it was paradise.
Mm.
So we take that stuff for granted a bit. And, yeah. I mean, it is, it's like paradise. It's just an incredible place.
Mm. I went all the way back through your Instagram page, and you do share a lot, which is really cool. Back to as far as it goes back. Why? And it seems like Tairua is a special place for you, always has been. Yeah. Why is that?
When my son was young, we'd take him to Tairua, and then... you know, we bought a place down there, and it's just, yeah, it is. It's, and I realized a few years ago that I got a lovely place down there, and I needed to spend more time down there. What's the use of building something beautiful and not using it? So, yeah, I love it down there, and I, just so much, it's just the simplicity of it is what I like. And the space, and the sea. You know, one of the things that I struggle with a bit being in New York for sort of so long was, you just don't see the ocean. We could see the Hudson River, but
not the same.
Bodies floating past and stuff like that. But it's a little bit different.
Yeah. So you're we're recording this 2 days before you're going in for a knee replacement operation.
Yep.
So how old are you? 61.
28.
Yeah. Aging, it's a barrel of laughs, isn't it? We were chatting about this just before. Like, I'm a runner. I've got knee issues. I have a big run, and then I'm fucked for a couple of days afterwards.
Yeah. Well, I've done pretty well because I don't do anything. So, I managed to sort of... I mean, considering I injured the knee in, 1982 or something, and now I'm finally getting operated on now. So it's been not a bad run, but I'm looking forward to it because, I'm still pretty active. I still like to do stuff, and like surf and various things. So I can't wait to get back and getting strong again.
Yeah.
Running though.
No, you've never been a runner?
No. I did at school. I remember I started off in an athletics club doing the 1500 meters. And then I went to the 800, 400, down to the 2 and 1, and then I'd become a high jumper because I worked out that the high jump was the least amount of effort required.
Like eight paces or something.
Yeah, and you just sit down in the sun, you're up, pass, and then you do, you probably do 4 jumps, It's just a great event. I loved it.
Unreal. I read on your LinkedIn page, and I really love this. I thought this is quite profound. This is your most recent post.
Yeah.
What's next? Two of the most exciting words in the English language, especially when you are completely open to where you might end up. Yeah, what is next? I mean, you're 61, but I feel like you've still got... I saw a thing online yesterday. It said at the age of 60, you've got probably at least 1,000 good weeks left. Yeah. I don't know if that's a grim way of looking at it or a positive way of looking at it.
I think I just decided to not push it and just chill and see what comes my way, and had some really interesting conversations since I've been back with all sorts of projects. And, some people just want some help, and which is great. I love doing that. And I think... I don't know what next, but I'm not worried by that. I know there will be a what next, but it's quite nice to just take a bit of time and just work on yourself a bit, instead of working for someone else. So I've been enjoying that. I've been enjoying looking at my laptop and finding some of the things that I wrote that I never finished, whether they're program proposals or scripts or whatever. It's been really cool to sort of just have time to finish them, because when you're looking at your documents folder or whatever and you see all these things and you're like, oh, I should have done that, I didn't finish that, it's nice to just get them sorted, you know. So I've been enjoying that. And I've been enjoying pizza.
Is there a good pizza place in
Tyro?
There's
a pizza truck in Tyro. It's awesome. Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah. Hey, well, it's been such a vast, varied and successful career. We'll go through all that. It's like a greatest hits. But let's go all the way back. So, yeah, memories from growing up. Where did you grow up? Where did the sense of humour come from?
So I grew up in South Auckland. Early days in Green Lane, but then my college was at De La Salle College in Mangere. Or Mangere when I grew up, but it's obviously different now.
That's with JK. You guys were schoolmates. Well, yeah, John Kerwin.
I was there first, and he followed. and so went to De La Salle College, which I think my time there best described as high spirited. Well, I got through it, and I met JK in the first 15. We're in the first 15 together. I was the number 8, and he was the halfback. And he just got bigger and bigger as the season got on. I love my time. I love South Auckland. It's so vibrant. And what I really like about it now is, obviously it was always... So when I moved there, it's a big freezing worker sort of population, and lots of people worked at Otahuhu Freezing Works, South Down and stuff like that. And then the Polynesian population really sort of really took off. And what I like now is the pride in the Polynesian heritage and culture that I see out there, which probably wasn't there when I grew up so much. I love that. I think it's awesome. And, even my school, as I got through the later years, was getting stronger and stronger Polynesian. Now it's probably 99% Polynesian. And it's just such a vibrant, amazing community. It's brilliant.
And on, you went to, I read this, I don't know if it's true or not, you went to primary school with JK, John Key?
Oh, no, well, I'm not sure. We had a chat about it. So I went to Cornwall Park Primary, and apparently so did he. And we worked out that we're about the same age. And I think we crossed over like 6 months. And when you're 5, you don't tend to remember people. Mm. But
unless it's your best friend that you sort of grew up with.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't remember him having a big impact at the time.
Yeah. And what about your sense of humour? Because you've got this sort of relentless self-deprecation. Does it come from your mum, your dad, grandparents? Where's that?
Dad's Italian. So
chef, right?
Chef, yeah. So he was a very funny man, but his sense of humour was... different. And mum, good Kiwi, and again, just a normal family, just a fantastic family. But I think I was just lucky. I think growing up, probably the biggest influence for me was watching John Clark, Fred Dick. I just used to love him, watching him and listening to him on the radio and buying his records and stuff like that. What I loved about it was incredibly talented, but never the self-deprecating thing I liked, because he never made out that he was the smartest guy in the room, but he was. But he didn't need to tell everyone. And he was a massive influence on me. I everyone in my generation, he was it. We had one comedian and it was him. And he was everywhere.
Yeah. It must have been nice for you going full circle when you were in Sports Cafe and you got to do a version of We Don't Know How Lucky We Are. What a hat tip.
I think that was probably of all the things I've done, that's probably one of the things I'm most proud of, is that I must have been watching the Olympics or something. Something was annoying me about the national anthem. Was just a bit boring, And I was like, we need a new national anthem. It should be, We Don't Know How Lucky We Are. And I listened to the record and it wasn't quite right. It wasn't as I had imagined it. It was like a poem over a guitar strum. And so I rang John Clark. I'd never met him before in my life. I hadn't, he had no idea who I was. And I said, look, mate, I'm Rick Sweetso. I do a TV show in New Zealand. You've never heard of it. But I'd love to bring We Don't Know How Lucky We Are to life as a national anthem. And he's like, I like the idea. I don't know who you are. Send me a copy of your show. And if I like it, I'll ring you back.
So, what episode do you send? Yeah, Jesus. A lot of thought goes into that one.
I think I just sent him the one from the previous week. And he rang me back, which was cool. And so we'd asked Neil Finn if he'd help, and Eddie Rayner if they'd work with Graham Hill on the music, which they did. And then I sort of said to John, I said, mate, I need you to write a new verse at the beginning and at the end to make it a bit more of an anthem. And he's like, cool, I'll give you a call. So he gave me a call about a week later. Here they are. And I was like, they're not quite right. And I remember thinking to myself, how am I going to tell John Clark that it's not quite what I'm looking for? Because, and he was so mean. I said, look, mate, we just need to tweak this because we're trying to do an anthem and anthems are more like this. And he's like, get it straight away. You're right. Bang. The next day, you know, came back and gave us the finished version. And then I just sat back and let them go, you know. Mm. And, I mean, yeah, he is. It's funny with things I was doing over the Christmas break as I was watching John Clark's stuff on YouTube, watching the old documentaries on him when he passed away. And just an absolute genius.
Mm.
Like clever, you know. And I remember him saying to me, you do know this song's ironic. I know that's what makes it funny. But it's
great. It is great though. It makes you, I don't know, it gives me goosebumps hearing that song. Yeah, it's bloody great. Yeah, makes you happy to be a Kiwi.
Yeah. Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Yeah. So so why journalism? So when you left school, you became like a journalist.
I applied for everything.
You're obviously quite a good footy player, right? Like you're in the first 59.
Nah, I was good enough. But I applied for everything. I applied to teachers' college. I hadn't spent a lot of time at school in my last year, I applied to journalism school not really knowing what it was, and I got in and I was like, sweet, I'll go to that then, because I knew it was really hard to get into. But in those days it was a 6-month course, and you had I think 400 applicants for 30 places, something like that, and I knew it was hard to get in. So if I got in, then I need to go and I'll work out what journalism is when I get there. So and that's why I showed up, and I got in trouble my first week. I'm trying to remember what I did. I threw something at a cricket game and ended up being locked up. And
like a Central Districts game or something. You threw
it was New Zealand India Test match, and
Fuck.
I knocked the hat off the policeman. They used to have those big tall hats.
Yeah, the big pointy ones.
And please, kids do not do that at home. That's terrible behaviour. And the next week I had to go to court, and I decided I was going to defend myself. And I stood up in the dock and looked into the gallery, and there's my class doing court reporting that day. And I'd called in sick. So it wasn't a great start. And then I did my remember they asked the plea and I went, not guilty. And the police prosecutor laughed. It's like, Your Honour, do you mind if we take him out the back and show him the summary of facts? And I went, well, that's not good, is it? That doesn't look good. I could get the electric chair on these summary of facts. So the detective inspector who caught me said, oh, look, I can't have a conviction. I'm going to be a journalist. I'm going to be a sports journalist. And they're like, okay, well, let's write a speech, you know, and let's apply for discharge without conviction under Section 42 of the Criminal Justice Act. So we wrote this beautiful speech. And so I went back in the dock and I just gave this beautiful piece of oratory. And the judge said, I'm a big cricket fan, and that's because of people like you. You spoil the game for people like me. Bang, gave me the maximum fine, gave me everything. And I looked at the policeman, and I was like, he's like, oh, fuck, we tried, you know. So it wasn't a great start to my journalism career.
It didn't hold you back, though, ultimately.
No, but I didn't get a certificate. I got a blank piece of cardboard, and just to make me feel better. And yeah, and then I got on the radio, and I think a lot of kids probably go through this. I think I'd just been at school too long, and I mean, thank God I didn't go to university. I knew that that once I got the workforce, you know, I'd be sweet. And so I ended up at Radio Pacific, which back then was out in Manukau, and
with Derek Lowe.
Derek Lowe, Gordon Dryden. Brent Impey, funnily enough, was the sports announcer. That's where I started.
He was a lawyer when I first got into radio. Before that, he was
a lawyer, but right. He used to do the Saturday sports show on Radio Pacific. So unreal. That's when I met him. Yeah.
Well, and then so you ended up in Tauranga at 1XX.
Yeah,
back then it was like either government owned, like the RNZ stations, or privately owned. Was that a privately owned one?
Yeah, so I always worked for the private stations. So there was a real rivalry between Radio New Zealand and the private stations. And so, you'd move around because that was how you got up the journalism ladder, you know, because we used to have grades, you know, so J1, J2, J3. Every time you moved, you got up a grade. So I went Pacific, Whakatane, Avon in Christchurch, Windy in Wellington. And I was at Hauraki in Auckland with Kevin Black and John Hooksby and Phil Gifford and all those guys.
Oh,
so,
my God.
Yeah, it was great times.
That was an incredible station, show too.
Yeah. So it was, and I loved radio. I loved working in private radio. Every radio station had its own news team, about 6-7 people. And it was just a golden age. It was brilliant. And some incredible broadcasters, amazing,
and some incredible characters too. Like when I started in 1990, like the guy that was my program director, Vaughan. Like I remember McDonald's had a sale, and it was like 99-cent hamburgers. So he went down there with like a Food Town bag, bought 50 of them, and put them in his freezer.
Yeah.
Just characters like that.
Yeah. No rules.
And then you end up on TV, right?
I went to London. I couldn't afford to go to Europe, so I rang up Andy Hayden and said, can you get me a contract? And he's like, who's this? And I said, I'm Rick. And so he said, look, I'll jack you up a club in Italy, but you'll have to be on trial. Go over there, and if they like you, they'll sign you, you know, and they'll sort you out. So, because rugby was an amateur game back then. Mm. And so went over, played the game. They signed me, and then they gave me a house and a car to, you know, and so I was there for a little while, and then at the end of that, I went over to London and did a couple of years working in radio there. And I remember when I was the Aussie stations that I was a foreign correspondent for rang my boss, and they said, "Mate, we can't have that wog name from London, so he's going to have to change his bloody name." It's like, so the boss came in and he said, sorry, you can't be Rick Salizzo anymore. So I was Richard Holmes, London. And and I was on the radio stations here as Richard Holmes, London. And my mum rang the radio stations going, that's not Richard Holmes, that's my son. I know that voice anyway. But yeah, so I was Richard Holmes.
And so how did you end up on TV? Because when you were on TV news here, was there only TV One news, or was there TV Three, or was this pre-TV3?
No, pre-TV3. So I came back from London. With Kathy, we both came back, and back then, if you worked in London, everyone thought that was incredible. So I went away as a pain in the ass that no one wanted, and came back from London, and everyone was like, "Oh, do you want a job?" And So I was hired to fill in for Jane Dent in the sports team, and Kathy came and she worked in the newsroom as a health reporter. So we were both hired because we came back from London.
Oh, so, yeah, so Kathy Campbell, your wife, we can talk about her later on if you want, but yeah, so you met in journalism school and you were
no, we met at Radio I. We met at Radio I. We worked in radio together, and then
you partnered up straight away.
Yeah, and she wanted to go. She was going to Europe, and I wanted to follow her, and I couldn't afford it, so that's why we played rugby.
Right, but the when you were on like TV sports news, it was like a golden age for news. I mean, you look at some of the names like Hawksby, Long, yeah. Sherry, Bradley, Bailey, D'Ordinary.
I had to read the. I started out as a reporter, and I was the first time the news team had assigned a reporter to the All Blacks, because up before that, before I came along, it was always like Graham Thorne or whatever, they'd be away on tour and they'd like chuck a microphone, and but the 87 World Cup was coming and they were like, you know, we need someone to travel with the All Blacks, and so that was me, which was pretty cool, you know. And and then one day I'd been doing some practice news reading with Richard Long, and he just, and this would never happen now, he's like, rang me up and he said, "What are you doing?" It was a Sunday afternoon. I said, "Nothing." He said, "Come on, you're going to read the news tonight." Didn't tell anyone, you know. So I ran. I think I was with Tom Bradley my first night, and so I read the news, the sports news, and then I did it again the week after with Angela D'Ordinary, and I got this review. So I got a call on, like, must have been the Monday, Tuesday morning from Richard Long going, "Don't read the Herald." So what do you mean? Don't read it. Come to work. I'll talk to you. So first thing I did was go to the gates.
And of course.
Steal someone else's Herald. Take it back. And my review was, and I remember it's burned in my memory. It was like, who is this guy? Rick Salizzo has a face like a red rubber tire. It's not so much when he should get off screen. It's how he ever got there in the first place is the question.
I was like, that's savage.
Man, that's harsh, eh? And I was angry for about, I don't know, 30 seconds. And then I got the giggles. I thought, that is really funny, the way that he's really attacked me. And but I carried on. I didn't get any better. My problem as a newsreader is I got easily distracted because, you know, you're reading the audio cue. And so all the work's been done. And it's 5 minutes work, 7 minutes work. And I'd be halfway through the order queue and my mind would start going, and I was like, oh yeah. And I remember one time, because I would, on the weekends, I would be the sports sub, so I'd decide what went in the news and read it and put it together. And there was a story, there's a brief period where I think it was the Sunday News turned into this really weird tabloid newspaper, and they did a story about someone had spotted aliens on the Rotorua golf course. So I had a Godzilla on my desk, so I got sent someone down, a cameraman, and I said, just go and put this Godzilla in various parts around the golf course and just film it, and then, you know, talk to the people about the aliens.
What sort of size are we talking?
Oh, I don't know, it would be, yeah, I don't know,
like 40 centimeters, like a plush toy.
Yeah. And they put it in the tree and stuff, so they'd interview someone and they'd put it in the tree behind them, like, no, I've never seen any aliens down here. It was sort of like a running gag, which you didn't do in the news back then.
It's very, what you're explaining is very crowd goes wild.
I know, but I so when it came back, we paid the item, and when it came back to Tom Bradley and I'd put this Godzilla thing between us on the desk and said to him something like, you know, imagine people thinking they're seeing aliens, they must be going nuts. And then, you know, now let's have a look at the weather. And I got called into the boss's office. Oh my God, did I get, like, who do you think you are? This is not a comedy show, you know, blah, blah, blah. I was like, oh man, I just got ripped apart. So at the end of that year, it's been 89, I was away on tour covering the All Blacks, and there was a story in the paper that I'd been dumped and replaced by, they got rid of me and Richard Beck, actually, and replaced us with Jeremy Coney and Phil Gifford. So,
and it was true. You had been.
Yeah.
You found out you were dumped by reading it in the paper.
Yeah.
That's outrageous.
Oh, it's pretty bad.
Actually, there's a lot of outrageous stuff in that story, like that review as well. Like,
oh yeah, I was pretty bad though. To be fair,
I don't know. I found a clip on YouTube of you and your early days. It was fine, wasn't it?
No, I would just go off on tangents and it was sort of almost like the prototype for Sports Cafe, but you know that's not the 6 o'clock news. I got into trouble a lot for not taking it seriously.
Do you think you might have ADHD and it was just never diagnosed a thing when you were a kid?
No, I don't know if it's ADHD. It's not so much. It's more that there's some strange stuff going on in this head. And once I start, oh, that's really interesting. I was like, oh my God, that's when trouble happens.
It sounds like ADHD. That's a great story about the Godzilla on the desk.
Yeah.
Like that's there's a lot of people that will be listening to this or watching this.
I need to get that. I need to.
Would it be in existence somewhere?
Must do. They must have kept the bulletins.
It's fucking groundbreaking because back then, as you said, like people, you didn't fuck with the news. No. It was half an hour a night and it was very serious. Like, there was no internet then. So this was that and the next morning's newspaper was the only source.
That was just before TV3 came on. So I think TV3 came in the end of 89 from memory, something like that. And I got into trouble then too because I...
I'm seeing a pattern.
Matthew Ridge, 1990. So Matthew Ridge changed codes, went to rugby league. And I knew he was doing it because I was going to do a doco on him. And at that stage, TV3 didn't have any rugby rights and they weren't actually allowed into Eden Park. So, you know, no one quite knew how the rights thing worked back then. And so they came in to do the press conference that Matthew was holding. And I remember saying to Matthew, don't say anything to them, you know, as you go past, because I knew they weren't going to be allowed in. And... they couldn't get into the press conference. Someone from Auckland Rugby shut the door on them. And so the cameraman kicked the door. And that was front page of the Herald, you know. network battle, you know. It was sort of like, oh, so I was in trouble again.
Mm-hmm. And then you ended up being the All Blacks first ever media liaison officer. This seems like quite a common thing now. I'm not sure who's doing it now, but it was Joe Locke for like 15 years or something. So there's very few people that have had it. So what was your... So this was 1992. By the way, how did you get the job? Because Laurie Maines was the coach. He hated your guts.
He didn't like me.
Yeah, why? What did you do to him?
I was from Auckland. That didn't help. But I did a story where I took an old grab of his and used it out of context. And I shouldn't have done it. And he was right to be angry with me.
Like if you did that now, the All Blacks would blacklist you, wouldn't
they? Oh, yeah. Well, he just didn't talk to me for about 5 years. And then... at the end of, so the 91 World Cup, the Aussies had a journo with them, a guy called Greg Campbell, and I thought, shit, that's a great idea. So I said to New Zealand Rugby, I wrote them a couple of pages on it, and I said, you should get a media liaison officer, you know, and because, you know, to deal with the media and stuff, and they were like, no, we're sweet. And then halfway through that tour in 92, they were getting into a bit of media strife, and... I get a call on my phone at, it must have been like 1 o'clock in the morning, I was in a bar, and they were like, can you come to the manager's room? I'm like, what have I done? Like, the night's not over yet. And so I went into the room, and Neil Gray was the manager, and George Berry was the CEO, and they're like, we've decided that we need to take you up on that offer of media liaison officer, you start tomorrow.
Wow.
And I said, so what do I do? And they said, well, you've got to work that out. Because we'd never had one, didn't exist. And so the next morning, I remember I got on I said to Fitzy, who was the captain, I said, what do I do? Like, they were off to practice. Do I just meet you at practice, or what do I do? He said, on the bus. And I said, I can't go on the bus, you know. And he's like, I'm the captain, get on the bus, sit next to me. So I got on the bus, sat next to him. And as I walked past Laurie said, what's that prick doing on the bus? No one had told Laurie.
Oh, he had no involvement in it at all. Him. Oh my God.
No, so so he wasn't happy. But yeah, I mean, we had some, Laurie and I had some interesting conversations for a while, but you know, eventually I got some really good advice from JK and Fitzy. They said, you know, in the All Black environment, you're going to get challenged all the time, and Laurie's going to challenge you, you know, because what you've got to do is just keep doing a great job day after day, and he'll learn to respect you. He doesn't have to like you, but he'll learn to respect you and then accept you. And that was sort of my mantra, is just keep, have a thick skin, and just keep turning up each day. And, you know, it was an amazing time. You know, I did it from 92 to the end of the 95 World Cup, which we lost. And, you know, got to see some amazing stuff. It was a real privilege and an honour to do that job.
And you did some, we'll talk about the Jonah stuff in a second, because you were media liaison when the Jonah fever sort of hit. There's actually a great old photo on your Instagram page of him like walking off the field and you just sort of over his shoulder, yeah. And he's swarmed by people. When we locked on this podcast, I bumped into Dame Julie Christie, and I said, "Oh, Rick's coming over. You know, anything I should say?" And she said, "Oh, I can't really offer you anything to say, but the stuff that he did with like the good, the bad, and the rugby was just groundbreaking. And it sort of, even though it doesn't have a direct link, it sort of set the way for what we see now with like Drive to Survive and other sport." And she was saying that the she reckons the All Blacks have gone back, like receded a long way in terms of openness and stuff. But that was, that was incredible. You look back now, you must be immensely proud of that.
Well, first of all, that's really nice, Julie. I mean, we both sort of started out at the same time. And, you know, I mean, the amount of times we crossed paths was incredible. I really appreciate that, Julie. So, I mean, it was sort of most of the things that I've done come from JK telling me that, you know, there's a problem, we need to fix it. And, I'd given him some offcuts of the 88 tour for his own private stuff, and he's like, "Oh, we should do a video, you know." And at that stage, there wasn't a VHS market. Like there was Alison Hall's cooking show and Jeff Thomas's Snapper Secrets were the only two that were for sale. And I didn't really know what I was doing. I just thought. I was there as a news reporter, and I was just like, well, if I just film a bit extra, and then when I come back, I'll cut it together into a documentary and put it on a VHS. The players were amazing. They just really embraced it. And I'd come down in the morning, and I'd go, "Where's the crew?" And they said, "Oh, the boys have gone out to play golf, taking the crew with them," or, you know, "The boys have gone here, they're taking the crew." So they really bought into it. And
it's very unpretentious, eh, the footage.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the motivation was, you know, for someone that had come into the environment from the outside, like myself, to realise that they were just normal people. It's like a club team, you know, just the same personalities and stuff like that. They were just really good at rugby. I came back at the end of the tour and I just cut it in my spare time with an editor over the Christmas break, and then we put it out. And I remember at that stage the biggest selling book was Colin Meads's biography, which had done 55,000 copies, and we were well over 100,000, you know. So
for the videotape,
yeah, the video went nuts. And people had to buy it out of garages and Wickalls and all that sort of stuff, because there was no shop selling videos, you know. But now, you know, I don't even have a copy of The Good, The Bad and The Rugby on VHS.
It's on YouTube now. Yeah, I watched some of the footage the other day. Yeah. It's great. It's really, really, it just sort of breaks down that wall between the All Blacks and the fans. I feel like that wall's back up now.
They were great people. Like, I was really lucky. I mean, I spent a lot of time, you know, and guys like Fitzy and... you know, Buck and Frano and Foxy and those sort of guys, you know, just really good people, really, they had a good balance, because, you know, they were working at the same time. And then, back then they were training Tuesday, Thursday, and, you know, only allowed like 3 days, I think, before a test match to assemble and stuff like that. Mm. So, they were just good people, and I really enjoyed my time.
Yeah, it's crazy to think, because I've had JK on the podcast, and we talked about how during the 87 World Cup, he was like bulleted out at people's houses and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, 87 to 92 is quite a big difference,
Just talking about JK, so he got injured early in that tour in 89, and he's got such a great brain. As he's getting carried off, he blew his Achilles, he's yelling at the crew, "Follow the ambulance. Get some shots of me going into the surgery." So the crew took off, jumped in the car, drove behind the ambulance, and they get these shots of JK getting wheeled into surgery and stuff like that, you know. So yeah, I mean, that was a real team effort. That was me and him, all those videos, you know. I had no idea what I was doing, so I cut it. It was like 2 hours long or something, 2.5 hours long, because I just wanted to put everything in. I had no idea about structure and pace and all those sort of TV terms. I just chucked everything in. It was like a giant home movie. Mm.
I've heard you say that a lot about almost every venture you've done, like you know, Sports Cafe. I had no idea what I was doing, but
it's true.
It must just be like an instinct you have, though.
No, it's true. I think I like putting stuff in order, like in an order, and that's essentially what you do in television: is you get a whole lot of stuff, and you put it in the right order, and the right pace and structure for me is everything, and I worked out pretty soon that I was, you know, quite good at that, and so, you know, that's what I really enjoyed. But yeah, that's not a self-deprecating sort of comment. I literally knew nothing about making documentaries when I made The Good, The Bad and Rugby. I worked it out as I went along. I literally knew nothing about doing chat shows and live shows when I did Sports Cafe until I started doing it, and I think that's that New Zealandness, and we're so naive sometimes, we don't understand the challenge. Just, oh, yeah, I'll give that a go. I'll be able to do that.
Yeah.
It's sweet, you know?
Yeah, like, how hard can it be?
I've just come back from running a rugby club in New York. I've never done that before, you know? So, but it's important, I reckon, to not be, like, have a little bit of fear, because that gets the adrenaline flowing, but not let that fear stop you trying.
Mm.
I say to people, you know, like the first episode of Sports Cafe, it was so bad. And I walked off the set and the crew wouldn't look at me. Like, so I'd look at the camera and they go, no one would look at me, except we had this one producer working with us, Alan Thurston, who was a genius, Thirsty, and as crazy as I was. And he looked at me and he gave me the thumbs up and he said, it was shit, but there's something there. And I was like, yeah, you're right, there's something there. You know, let's build on that. So you've got to start. I mean, that's the easiest piece of advice. You just got to start.
It is, and fail and learn from your failures is where the growth happens, right?
Yeah, or just I always think that when you make a TV series, that you know that the first episode is going to be a bit crap, because you put all this thought into it, and then you put it out there, and you overthink it, and then it's not till you see the first one you go, ah. I just change that and change that and change that. And then the second one's better, and then the third one's normally humming.
Mm.
That's what I've found.
Yeah. We'll dig deep on that soon, the TV stuff, because, you've had two TV shows that lasted for a decade or more, which is incredible by New Zealand standards, right?
Yeah.
It's remarkable. But, just back to the Jonah stuff. So Jonah comes on the team. He's how old, like 18, 19?
Yeah, so
he's a kid, eh?
Really young, and he played two tests against France, and then they decided to drop him. Is not really the right word. They sort of said, "Look, I think you need a bit more time." So they replaced him, whatever the next tests were. I think we played South Africa, and then the 95 World Cup. He was close to the squad, but didn't make the initial squad, and I remember Eric Rush, the team was due to play a warm-up game in Hamilton, and Eric Rush got injured, and so they called Jonah up from the, I don't know, wider training group or the New Zealand 15, and he came up and he just destroyed everyone at training. I remember he hit the bag and Richard Lowe went back 20 metres back, and then he hit the next bag and Jamie Joseph went another 20 metres back. I was like, oh man, I think we need to pick him. And but like when we got to the World Cup, because he hadn't set the world on fire in 94, I went down the night before the first game with him to talk to media, and no one showed up. Like, not a single person. And him and I were just standing in the foyer of the hotel really awkwardly going, I don't think anyone wants to talk to you, Jonah. You can go back to your room.
Was there no sort of heat around him at that time?
No, because he wasn't a star at that stage. You know, he was a guy who'd played two tests and then missed the test against South Africa. And, you know, even the game before the World Cup warm-up test was against Canada, and he came off the bench. So the next night, the guys opened the World Cup against Ireland, and he just destroyed Ireland.
Mm.
Like, unbelievable. And from then on, it was like, I don't know, a rugby version of Taylor Swift. It was just incredible. Far out. Everywhere we went, he was just getting mobbed. And so my job after a test match was to run on the field and protect him and help him get off the field.
You see, you must have been in a good spot because you'd been media liaison for 3 years at that point. So yeah. you'd sort of created this job and job description for yourself. Yeah. But 3 years and you've got a fair idea what you're doing. But you still, to a degree, must have felt like a deer in the headlights. Because
I never dealt anything like that before. You know,
yeah, it must have been insane.
And we did a supermarket visit, and before we went and mixed with the fans, we went up and did some signing for the managers and stuff. And then outside there was about 300 people waiting for the All Blacks. And so I said, "Oh, Sean, if you can lead them out." And so Sean led them out, and this lady came up to Sean and she said, "Oh, I've been waiting for you for so long. About 3 hours I've been waiting here for you. You know, please, you're my favourite player. Can you sign this rugby ball?" And he wrote SEA, and Jonah walked past and she ripped the ball off him. And Jonah started running, and everyone ran with Jonah. I remember standing next to Sean, there was no one left. Like the rest of us were just standing there going, "Oh, well, I was going to have a coffee then, boys."
Wow, what a crazy time to be part of that.
Yeah.
Crazy thing to experience.
He was
incredible. What was he like? Was he quite shy? The All Blacks was quite a, there was a real sort of hierarchy thing at that point. Who did he hang out with? Was it like Rushy and Bunsey?
Yeah, Frank and Eric and those guys. But he's a good guy, had a good sense of humour. The only thing, like, for some reason he decided he wanted to play fight me all the time. So I'd be walking down a corridor and he'd jump out and just give me a hook into the guts or something like that. And then he'd disappear and I'd be doubled over. Oh, yeah, good one, Jonah. Oh, God. You know? So, yeah, I really enjoyed Jonah's company. He was one day he ate a bowl of boiled eggs and there must have been 20 of them in there. And so, and then Laurie decided he didn't play that well the next game. So eggs were off. No one else was allowed to eat the eggs. So, yeah, it was just, I mean, he was really young. I think he was calm, though. I always felt him really calm. You know, all this crazy was going on. He had Phil Kingsley-Jones, who was managing it all, so he could just let Phil do that. Anything in the team, he could let me do this. And one of the things I always felt with Jonah is he loved being part of the family. You know, he loved being an All Black, and he loved, you know, his friendship with Rushy and Frank and those boys and the team. And he really blossomed. As the stronger a sense of belonging to the team, the better he played. And, you know, no more so than when he destroyed England. And I think that was really important to him. I think to feel part of that All Black family was a big part of it for him.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, a tragic end to his life. And you look back at some of the stuff he went through, like having to go on the home show to apologise when he got married and didn't tell his family. You look back now, it's like personal shit. It shouldn't have been it's alarming. You look back and but thanks for sharing those stories. I love nothing more than a Jonah story.
Yeah, he's a good man. I think at the end of the day, you know, when you what was Jonah like? Jonah was a good man.
Mm, that's cool. So then the TV stuff. So Sports Cafe. How did they? There'll be a lot of people listening to this that are like me, massive fans of it and have nothing but fond memories of it. And there'll be a lot of people that won't even remember. But this was groundbreaking stuff. And you say you don't know what you were doing, but I was in commercial radio at the time and we had consultants all the time. So what you were essentially doing was like, whether you knew it or not, was like a breakfast radio show on TV.
Oh, big time,
You had like the goofball.
Yeah.
You had the straight man. Yeah. You had
so that was my background, you know, so breakfast radio. And so that very much was on my mind. We created it because, again, you know, JK and I are having a couple of beers and we're talking about how we never really got to see the players express themselves on TV shows, you know, because, and we wanted to create that sort of touring sort of type environment where, you know, it was really loose and stuff like that. And initially it was going to be JK, me and Zinni. Then JK couldn't make the pilot show. I brought in a Tanya from Radio B, and the only person I knew in the Warriors, because I got JK because he was a Warrior at that stage, the only person I knew in the Warriors other than JK that was available was Macca. So So I rang Macca up and I said, do you mind filling in for the pilot? And I remember he walked into the makeup room wearing normal clothes and came out with a suit from the 1970s. Don't know where he found it. And he changed, at that moment, he changed what was going to be a serious, relaxed show into what it turned into be. And then JK rang me up and said, mate, I'm really busy. I don't think I'll do the first few shows. And I said, oh, don't worry about it, mate. We're sweet. We'll use Macca. And
he was a phenomenal talent, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
Just incredible. I was at that age, I suppose in my early 20s, mid-20s at the time. Me and all my mates started sort of talking like him.
Oh, yeah. Same I sort still of see it today. I still see people, a lot of people, you know, even sometimes when I listen to some of the ACC guys, I think, oh, they sound like Macca, you know. Mm. Yeah, massively influential. And, you know, like just a genius around timing and all that sort of stuff. Sometimes he put zero thought into it. Sometimes he put, you know, 3% thought into it. But he used to sit behind me on the All Black bus and he used to just crack me up all the time, just, you know, just abusing everyone and taking the piss out of everyone. So I knew he was funny. I didn't realise it was that funny. And then he just became really annoying.
Yeah, so your role on Sports Cafe was sort of like the anchor or straight man, whatever you...
Yeah.
The links man, whatever you want to call it. And you always looked fucked off with him. Were you, or was that an
act? Oh, there was sometimes I was, yeah. I mean, he thought that the show was funny because I put so much effort into it and he ruined it. He thought that was the concept of the show. Like, oh yeah, you're going to make a show and I'm going to ruin it. That's a brilliant concept. I was like, no, that's not what I'm looking for. But the one time I got really angry was when he was drunk, and I'd put a lot of work into the show, and you know, had some good guests and stuff like that. And I rang him at 1 o'clock. I knew he was at lunch, and I was like, mate, you sound like you've had a few. Are you going to get home soon? Yeah, I'm on my way home. And I kept ringing him. He was still there. 6 o'clock, still at lunch, you know, and we used to start, let's say, 8:30. 7:30, still at lunch. I said, mate, I need you to come. I need you to leave now. So we started the show. Pretty sure we started. He wasn't even there. But he might have been there 2 minutes before we went live on air. He walked in, and he was so drunk. And I'm like, what are we going to do here? And he had this... because he was always trying to sell his Nude Day t-shirt. So he grabbed a Nude Day t-shirt, put it over his big jacket. He looked like the Michelin man. And then the way my brain works is like, he's really drunk. I'm just going to keep throwing questions at him. I'm just going to catch him out. I'm just going to make his life a nightmare. And then at the commercial break, I said, get him out of here. I'm going to kill him. Get him out of here. He'd kicked a ball into someone's face in the audience. He just had a nightmare. So they took him over to get some coffee into him. And we put we had a fiberglass cow in the set. And we put it in Mark's spot. And just as we came back from commercial break, I looked over and there's Macca arguing with the cow. I was like, what are you doing in my spot, mate? Like, so after the show, everyone knew to get out of my way. So I'm like, upstairs, mate. So Macca went upstairs, I ripped into him. I was like, that is so unprofessional. You've made me look like an idiot. You know, who do you think you are? Blah, blah, blah. Ripped him in. The reality is that now that show's gone down in history. For many people, it's the funniest show we did. So, you know, once again, he wins. You know?
But on reflection, yeah, what makes you wince? I had Lee Hart sitting in that chair. He still talks years on about regretting about killing a snail live on TV, which seems like a small thing, so, but he just thinks it's pointless and it's something he wouldn't do now. What about you? Is there anything that you look back on and go, ooh?
Posing for photos for Nude Day was probably not my finest
hour. Nude Day was like a cultural phenomenon, though, wasn't it?
What I loved about it, you know, these influencers nowadays, I think back then we could get most of New Zealand to go naked for a day. Macca would say, you know, you have permission from the police, which they didn't. And people would send us in videos of themselves nude doing stupid stuff. Like, that's influence.
Yeah, well, there were even cops involved, weren't there? Cops posing nude on the cop car. And
no, the Gore policeman did a whole thing and he got the sack.
Wow.
And it was front page of news. And then couple of weeks later, the local fire brigade also did the Nude Day stuff. So, yeah, people really got into it. It was funny. It was so funny.
Oh, it was just an incredibly well done show.
And but then, now we get all these lawyers and doctors coming up to me at functions going, you know, in 1998, the Nude Day tapes, do you still have those? Because I sent an entry and I'd prefer if no one ever saw it, you know.
Well, the hard thing now is to be finding like a player to play the tapes on, even if they were still in existence. And it was amazing. And then your final show, you even had like a video message from Helen Clark.
Oh, yeah.
Who was the Prime Minister at the time. You think now... whoever the Prime Minister is, even if it's a fun Prime Minister like a John Key or a Chris Luxon, they'd have people saying, no, think of the optics.
Yeah, she had a good sense of humour. I mean, the thing is, the reason I think Sports Cafe worked because, you got to take the guys that John Follette and Nate Smith, who were the sort of people that run Sky, that they said, so they didn't give us any money. They just said, here's an hour of TV. You've got to raise the money through sponsorship and advertising. But we're going to let you go. Just don't get our license taken off, you know.
Mm.
And they were really supportive, even in the early days. So they gave me the confidence to try things because I knew I wasn't going to get taken off air. I mean, the first year we did 40 shows, And the reason we did 40 is I worked out that if I got paid X amount of dollars per show, I'd have to do 40 shows to get enough. So like that's not always the case in television. You know, you don't normally get that freedom and so I'm really thankful for those guys.
And was it live?
Yeah. It was live for probably 90% of the time. We did this our 10th year anniversary. By that stage we were on TVNZ and because our sponsors wanted a bigger audience, and we did our 10-year anniversary show, and for some reason there was a problem with the link, and I said welcome to the show, and then it cut out, and no one saw the rest of the show. We didn't realise we did the show, and no one saw it. They had to run a standby show. So then TVNZ ripped me apart, and they're like, this is disgraceful. You can't do that again. You need to record it an hour early so we can make sure it's in-house before we play it.
Mm.
And so that was what we did the last year. But the irony of that is weird. So our show was, I think, 46 minutes. And then the rest of the hour was made up of commercial breaks. But we had this new person working for us. And she timed it at 46 minutes, then took commercial breaks off. So we did this recorded show, which they wanted us to do. And I was like, shit, that was over quick. And then we were inside having a beer. And then... I get this call from TVNZ going, hey, guys, you're like, I don't know, 13 minutes short. I'm like, well, we can't. There's nothing we can do about it. Like, I don't know. I'm on the floor. I don't know how long. I'm just waiting for the director and a director assistant to give me cues. So, yeah, so that didn't work that well.
Oh, my God. But, I'm thinking there was another sort of master of New Zealand TV at the time, in my opinion, Mikey Havoc. And he did a live show once, which was just diabolical and disastrous. So there's...
He came... him and Newsboy started, I think, the year after us. And it was a good time. I mean, we'd watch their stuff. And, Graham Hill had come from BFM, so he knew them pretty well. And there was a bit of crossover. And then Graham went and worked on... Jeremy's, I can't remember.
What like Eating Media Lunch.
Eating Media Lunch. Yeah, Graham was one of the guys on that, one of the geniuses behind that. So it was nice. It was a nice little crew of people, a lot of, Paul Castley and stuff. They were really smart guys, you know. So there's a lot of sort of, you're sharing each other's success.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking as you're speaking. So there was the core cast of Sports Cafe, but then this just that peripheral cast, which was phenomenal. You know, the Human Cannibal, Eva from Bulgaria. That guy who we mentioned Lee Hart. It's incredible. You're quite the talent spot, right? I'm interested to see how you deflect this one because you've made so many careers.
Yeah, I think it's sort of giving people a chance, like, and then giving them time to find their voice. I think that's been the key. I love watching the news at night and seeing Hayley Holt on the news, you know. Those sorts of things I really enjoy. That's probably what gives me the greatest buzz, is seeing people that come through, you know, the Mark Richardson sort of stuff. Lee Hart, you know. I mean, Lee's still, I'm biased, but I reckon he's the funniest guy in New Zealand. And you know, we just gave him an outlet and then he just took off, and, you know, the rest is on him. And we got him in because Macra and I were talking about this character, and we wanted to do something funny, and he knew Lee, you know. He said, oh, I've been talking to Lee about it, and Lee's got a whole bio about this guy, you know. He's really prepared this, and it's very funny. So so he came in, and Lee had done a brilliant job in really putting a backstory behind the character, which is not something we ever did before. And then about a week later, 2 weeks later, Norm Hewitt had to do a very tearful apology on TV.
That's right. He got drunk and ended up smashing a ranch slider to the wrong hotel room or something.
Yeah, I can't remember.
But, yeah, it was awful.
But then Lee Hart did a parody of it, and he did an apology because he said, look, you know, I'm not really a snail racer. I don't really know how fast these things can go, you know. And so I knew. So the next year I was like, because Lee was working for a Greenstone at that stage, production company, as a researcher. And I was like, mate, you need to come full time and be with us. So the first 3 or 4 weeks, he made up a different name every time. I remember he was doing a piece to camera at the viaduct, and he goes, and he signed off, Rick, and he turned around, the boat was called Crescendo. Rick Crescendo, you know. But then I said, mate, we just need a generic name. Let's just call you that guy, and let's just go from there. And I mean, he is so clever, you know. But so is, you know, the Cannonball and Eva the Bulgarian. I mean, they were really smart people. They knew their characters, and they knew, you know, it's really playing. You take some of your own qualities and you exaggerate them into a character, and that's why it's always funny for me whenever I go into meetings. You know, serious business meetings, people see me as the guy that presented Sports Cafe, not the guy that made it. So they think I'm an idiot, you know. So I'm trying to get something really important across, and they go, oh, yeah, where's Eva the Bulgarian, you know. So, you know, and we haven't talked about Lana. I mean, without Lana.
Yeah, yeah.
Lana's dry humour. I heard her at a function before she worked for us, and I was like, oh, man, she... Everyone thinks that she's like this and she's like that, and that's funny. And so when we had the opportunity to put her in there, she was only supposed to do a couple of weeks, and she did, like, you know, 12 years. She was sort of the glue that kept us together.
Oh, she played that role particularly well too. Like, sometimes she'd side with you, sometimes she'd side with Mark.
Because I think what would happen with me is I'd get angry with Mark, and then he'd suck me in, and I'd get caught up in his stupid ideas. You know, no, we're not going to do that. No. Well, actually, if we do, you know. And then Lana would slap me across the face. No, Rick, don't be fooled by him, you know. So, yeah. And none of that was...
like contrived?
Not in the early days. And as we got through, sort of started to understand the dynamics and work out how to play with them. Very much like Breakfast Radio. You know, it's like, well, I know my character, you know your character, so let's
stay this. In your lane.
Yeah. So it was very much like a Breakfast Radio show.
And then Crowd Goes Wild after that. Well, yeah. I'm brushing over Sugar Shack. You don't want to.
Sugar Shack was cool because I got it wrong.
Right. You know what? I've got a really good memory about like pop culture and TV. I don't remember this at all.
No,
Sugar
no.
Shack at all. But is this the only fail you've had?
Oh, no, there's a few. There's Sugar Shack, which had a great group of people. I don't know why I couldn't make it work. But I was starting Crowd Goes Wild at the same time, and I was spreading myself a bit thin. I also did a show. I did a show called The Bradley Bunch, which we did one episode of. And the idea was that news has changed. So we brought Tom Bradley back. Which was actually Jeremy Wells' idea, and then we put everything around him. So we had Paul Ego as a consultant, and we had Carly Binding, who was his female presenter, because you couldn't do the news without a female, and we had a band. And I'd been at the comedy club, like the classic, like 5 days before we were due to film this pilot, and I was watching this act, and never heard of them before, and afterwards they were in the foyer selling CDs and stuff, and I went up to them and I said, do you want to be in my TV show? And they're like, what do you mean? I said, I'm doing a TV show on Thursday, And you guys are really funny, so you should be in it. And so they were in it, and they fly the Concords. And so they were hilarious. I'd never seen them before. They were just starting out. And I remember when TVNZ, after the show, and it wasn't my greatest work, but it was just, we're just trying some stuff. And they were like, nah, don't even talk about that show. Don't even try and resurrect it. Don't even mention it in the hallway. And I was like, yeah, I know, I get it. But the band were quite funny, eh? And they're like, oh, were they? And I was like, oh, fuck, I think so.
I love a story like that, because they were really sort of bruised by their experience at TV, yeah. Weren't they? They wanted to change the entire sort of concept of the show and make it. I don't know what they wanted to make it, but then the BBC saw something in them.
I love their success.
It's phenomenal.
They're two really good people. You know, I and Reese. You know, they're all really, really good people. And so, you know, sometimes in New Zealand, you know, people sort of go, oh, if they see someone else's success, they get a bit shitty, because it's like, oh, you're leaving me behind. I want to pull you down, et cetera, et cetera. But the Concords are just, incredibly talented. All right, you can see from that first time we saw them. And you know, so, I mean, I love their success, because it's true talent finding its true place. And, but they didn't find it in the Bradley Bunch.
It's amazing. Is it on YouTube or anything?
I don't know. I've got a copy.
Yeah.
It sits along Sugar Shack.
And so crowd goes wild. I remember seeing Andrew Mulligan at a mate's party one Christmas, and I think it was at the end of year one of Crowd Goes Wild, and I was saying how much I love the show, and he was saying it was about to end.
Yeah.
Or it wasn't looking likely that it was going
to
continue.
So Sky used to have a show called Sport 365, which was their first sort of attempt at a new show, and it was fine, it was going okay, and Andrew Mulligan was working as a producer on that show. And then I got a call one day, completely out of the blue. John Follett, who was running Sky, rang me, and he said, look, I need to change 365, it's not working for me, can I give you the resource of 365, and can you turn it into something? I'm like, yeah, I can, but I'm a little bit busy at the moment, because I'm with Mark Ellis and two policemen. They've just let him come home to put a suit on, because we're going to court. So he was going to court.
Oh, was this for the selling some ecstasy?
Yeah. Right. So that, I remember it vividly, you know. So we got through that, and then I came into Sky, and I was like, I got a whole lot of people for auditions, and because Miles was working for Sky, I asked them to sit in on the auditions. And we went through, I don't know, 10 people. I knew that I wanted to use Mark, because I'd actually used Mark on an episode of Sports Cafe, Mark Richardson. Mm. But I wasn't planning on using Andrew. And then I looked through all the auditions, and I was like, man, Andrew's better than all. He's the best. Mm. He's so good. And the chemistry between him and Mark will work really well. So we put them together, and then, what was that, 2006? And it's still going today. I'm not involved with it anymore.
Are you still executive producer?
No. So when I went to the US, I sort of moved away. But I mean, all right, Andrew's done a phenomenal job. Mm. And I really, in those early years, it was so much fun. Because, again, you're just finding your voice. And some brilliant people have gone through. I mean, we started... Glenn Osborne was the original reporter for Crowd Goes Wild. Mark's very good, just so clever, knows his character really well, bounced off Andrew really well. You know, then we, during that first year, we brought Maccone in,
which is a masterstroke.
Yeah, and it was, so I saw Maccone at a rugby function, a blues function, and he was just, leaving the Herald, you know, and I said, what are you going to do? He said, I don't have anything on. I said, well, just come and help us out, give you a couple of shifts, you know. And and then he just got, you know, just realised just how talented he was.
Mm. But you've sort of given like opportunities or TV jobs to people that would never have got it from like one or three for whatever reason, and it's proved to be like a masterstroke. There's been as you mentioned Hayley Holt before, some remarkable careers. Like,
yeah, it's cool, eh? It's just giving the people the opportunity. And then I think sometimes in our industry, you know, a producer or someone will hire someone because they see something in them, and then they'll try and turn them into what they think they should be.
Mm.
Whereas it's actually easier just to let them be themselves.
Yeah, I think what you're describing is what happened with Flight of the Conchords, right? Yeah, trying to mold them into what they thought.
I think it happens with lots of people.
Yeah,
You go and someone sees you've got some talent, and this, I'm talking global. They see you've got some talent. They go, right, we're going to give you this show. Here's your script. This is what I want you to say. This is how I want you to act. This is what I want you to be. Whereas my strategy is a lot easier. It's like, okay, can you come in and just be yourself, and I'll just sit back and watch.
Mm. Yeah, because I've had Mark Richardson on the podcast, and he talked about we talked about the sketch that he did with Stephen Fleming.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
His recollection is that that's when he came onto your radar.
Yeah,
because you thought that sketch with Stephen Fleming
was funny.
Yeah, hilarious.
Yeah.
So awkward to watch.
Yeah.
Brilliantly awkward.
But that's the thing about Mark, is he understands his character really well. So he knows why it's funny, so he can replicate it, you know, because he's like, well, this is what I do really well. I can play that role. So every time he gets that opportunity, he comes in with a one-liner. He knows his character, and I think that's what he does well.
Yeah, fuck, we've talked about a lot of high-profile stuff. There's something that I want to talk about. It's a book that you've done, which is probably...
Oh, yep.
Not very high profile. I've got the book right here. It's called I Know This To Be True, which is amazing. It's basically, it's a beautiful coffee table book. Came out 2016?
I don't know. 17? Yeah, 20, something like that, yeah.
And it's just beautiful photos and glossy photos and sort of interviews with like 60 well-known New Zealanders and not so well-known New Zealanders. It's kind of like a podcast, long-form podcast pre-podcasting.
So I worked on that with a mate of mine, Jeff Blackwell, who's an incredible book publisher, and he's just really good at that stuff. And
there you go, deflecting again.
Yeah, and I did the interviews and stuff, and we sort of created the format as we went, which was we had the piece of art that had I Know This To Be True, and we had the traipse set around everywhere.
Yeah, like a massive canvas backdrop.
It's ridiculous. I just got so sick of carrying that thing. It's such a great idea. And then everyone, I'd do this interview with them about their values and about what they knew to be true in their lives and stuff. And then I'd get them to come up with a word that summed up their values and what they thought. And we'd take a photo with that word on their body. And then we'd get them to sign the canvas at the back, put the word up, and they were auctioned it for Play It Strange, because a lot of it was for Mike Chun's Play It Strange. But for me, it was a gift, because I got to speak to 60 incredible people and have a really sort of private, intimate conversation with them about what was important in their lives.
How long was each chat?
Probably 40 minutes to an hour each one. I was lucky to grab Colin Meads just before he passed away, actually, and he was a very good friend of mine, and it was a really special time. And they were all, everyone left a mark on me, and I learned a lot from doing them. I did JK and Macca. I think they both made me cry, actually. I know Macca did. And then...
did they? You can't remember what?
I think Macca, we were just talking about love.
Mm.
And, it was such a great gift. And then one of the people I spoke to was a lady, Elizabeth Ransom, who had sold her business to Google for... I think $250 million, She'd done incredibly well. And she was an amazing, amazing story. God, I just really loved talking to her. And I interviewed her over in Palo Alto and in California. And at the end of it, she sort of challenged me a little bit. She said, well, what are you going to do next? You're doing this book. When this is finished, what are you going to do next? And I'm like, oh. She's like, because the media world's changing, television's changing. So you can't just trot out Sports Cafe again. Oh, bugger. and so I came back from when that book got published, and I started to really think about what next. And as a result of that, I started building, I built an app, a platform really, around fan engagement, around how to, because again, JK and I talked about there was a real problem getting, 20-year-olds to watch live sport, and that was so important to us, live sport. And so we sort of built this thing, and it was testing really well. And so I thought, okay, well, let's just go to America. I'll just move to America. Mm-hmm. So and it was all because of that conversation I had doing the book, and I ended up in Austin, Texas, and spent a year sort of trying to get things off the ground, and then COVID hit, so that sort of put an end to that.
Mm. Oh well, still in the scrapbook of ideas.
Yeah, yeah, no, mate, very much so.
Yeah, now you mentioned Colin Meads in that book, The Sun Out to Be True. I've actually got that highlighted here. This is one of my favourite parts in the book, and I think when I read the book when it first came out, I thought it was kind of savage and badass. And in the time that's passed, I've gone through my own mental health stuff, and I actually find this paragraph kind of sad now in a way. So he was, I think, 80.
I know it is about crying.
Yeah. He was 80 at the time. It was like a year or two before he died. I can't remember.
It was like months before he died.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, yeah.
He still talked in the article about enjoying going out for a few beers.
Yeah.
But the paragraph is, I can't remember when I last cried. Probably when I got a hiding at home as a kid, or when I was 7 and had rheumatic fever and got told I had to stay in bed for 8 weeks. I might have cried then.
Yeah.
At the time, I thought, fuck, this is cool. This is so Colin Meads, Pine Tree Meads. And then I look back now, and it's like, vulnerability and being able to cry and stuff is like a really, it was probably perceived as a weakness then. It definitely was when I was growing up. But you look back now, and it's like a key part of living a full human existence.
Yeah.
It's kind of sad.
Yeah, he was... I love Colin. He was such an amazing man. So when I worked for the All Blacks, he was the manager. So we had a pretty close bond. And I couldn't believe it when he told me that. It's bullshit.
3/4 of a century without crying. Come on, it's mate. Insane.
He's like, no, and when he said it, it wasn't a contrived comment for effect. He generally thought, because I asked that question of a few people, and he generally thought about it. And he went, oh, Jesus, shit, I don't know. Probably when I was, 5 or 6. I was, fuck. Colin, dude.
It's crazy.
But it just, we don't know. It was a different time, you know.
And yeah.
He had it tough, man. He worked hard, you know. He would tell me about, how his father bought some land up the road, and him and Stan had to cut all the shrub, do after school. And he said to me that he loved going to rugby because it gave him a break from cutting shrub in the farm, gave him a break from, rugby was relaxing compared to all the work they had to do on the farm. Just an amazing human being.
Mm. And do you cry much? Are you much of a crier? Have you found you cry more and more often as you get older?
I'm half Italian, so there's plenty of emotion there. I do. I find sometimes I tear up a bit when I'm really grateful for things. If I'm looking at an old clip or something, and I was so lucky to have that opportunity to make that or work with those people or. And that will bring a tear to the eye. And the other thing that, apart from stubbing my toe, the other thing that...
when you were 7.
Yeah, if I see something where someone's got incredible talent, that just blows me away. I reckon it's the thing, one of the things I love most is seeing people with talent. I just love just sitting back and going, oh my God, that person has just got something special. I'm not talking about rugby players and stuff like that. I'm talking about just, seeing someone do a song or put a show there. Like, I love The West Wing and Aaron Sorkin, and quite often at the end of that I'll be in tears. And I'll be in tears not because the show was something that got to me. It's just because I'd be in tears going, that was just an incredible piece of work. I can't believe someone managed to make that piece of art for me, and those are the times where I just a tear will come to the eye, and I was just, oh my God, that's just incredible,
Wow.
Yeah.
It's funny, when I had Matthew Ridge on the podcast, he said a similar sort of thing, actually. He said he loves a good cry now, and he said he can be just driving along this car thinking about, people or things that he's grateful for, and just to have tears.
He's a great dinner. Great human being, Reggie.
Yeah, he's wonderful. Wonderful chat. I think it feels like he's got better with age,
So I did. So JK and I did a documentary with him when he changed codes. So we followed him from the moment he landed in Australia to his career at Manly.
That's on YouTube as well, by the way, if anyone wants to look at it.
I think actually it's still the highest rating sports doc of all time because there was only like one channel when we did it. But and I got to know him really well then, and such a really smart, really good man.
Mm. Now, how's your mental health been over the years?
Yeah, I think pretty good. I think I got a shock, obviously, being really close to JK, watching him go through his through his issues, and I didn't understand it. I didn't know, couldn't help. I just didn't know, you know, when he tried to talk to me about it, I just didn't understand what he was talking about, because back then it was just not spoken about. So I think because of our friendship, I've always been really conscious of it. You know, I probably don't want to talk too much about, you know, losing Kathy, but that was a pretty tough time for me. Mm. And, you know, I was really thankful to have JK in my corner, you know, to sort of help me get through some of that stuff. But, you know, I mean, we all go through tough times. I think what you learn is you can't judge people because you just don't know what's going on and what their story is, you know. Mm. You know, so yeah, I'm conscious of it, but it's always a work on, you know, like yeah. anyone. I'm, like, you know, particularly when you're a creative person, you make something and you put it out there, you know, and you get called a red rubber tire or whatever, you know, it's funny to laugh at it, but it can be hard. I remember...
Yeah, it stings.
I used to... I think it was... So Sports Cafe was always on a Wednesday night, and I became really conditioned on a Thursday to be... Like, it was almost physically I would sort of curl into a ball. Even when I'm walking out, I'd be really tight, because I was just waiting for people to, you know, that we'd got something wrong or we'd done something naughty or something like, you know, in a supermarket or something, I'd be waiting for someone to attack me. And so even after the show finished, like for a couple of years afterwards, I would always be really, really tired on a Thursday and really quiet, because I would just want to hide from the world on that day.
Mm.
And then once we got through Thursday, I was okay, you know. But I remember one day I was driving down the Waihi Beach and I stopped to get some petrol, and I was filling the car up, and, you know, you can sense when someone's behind you, you know, and like these people behind me. And I turned around and they were looking at me and laughing. And I said, what's the problem? And they said, oh, we're just seeing if you had a hairy ass like Macca said on the show last night. Because Macca decided, because I'm half Italian, I must be hairy. So, you know, that was my life for a long time.
That's great. Yeah. I don't think, like, the fact that we can sit down and have a conversation like this now, we can't underestimate the cultural impact that John Kirwan's had on this country.
Oh, incredible.
You know, it's like remarkable. It's easy to talk about mental health and resilience and vulnerability now, but he was doing it when no one was doing it. I can't imagine how terrifying that was to come out.
I remember when he rang me, because he would send me the chapters of his book to read and give him some feedback, and he sent me the one on his depression called Black Dog, and he's like, I don't know if I'm going to put this in. And I read it and I was like, oh my god, why didn't you tell me that this was happening? I didn't understand, because we were working together, we had a company together, Pastor Productions, and he's like, I think I need to put it in, I think I need to. But it was, there was a lot of thought about, you know, exposing that side of his life, because at that stage no one had ever done that before, and it was a rugby book, you know. It's like, you know, tell me how many try you scored and what was it like the night after the World Cup final and stuff. Like, that's what rugby books were. And he had this chapter about, you know, dealing with depression and where it got to him and stuff. But I know, and I'm sure he's told you this, that, you know, when he goes out, I mean, you know, obviously we go out a fair bit, people will come up to him constantly and go, you've saved my brother's life, my father, my husband, you know, particularly males, you know. And yeah. You just wonder whether, you know, his All Black career was really designed to give him the profile to really do his good work.
Yeah, the platform.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he's normalised it. I do worry about like the likes of him and Mike King and my friend Jazz Thornton as well. Like yep. they take a lot on, and then you get people coming to you, not with just with positive stories like that, but also wanting help or advice. Yep.
But the good thing with JK is he's written a beautiful book, All Blacks Don't Cry, which is what I, you know, when people... Because a lot of people still come to me and say, well, I'm struggling, you know, can you give me JK's number? And I go, cool, you need to read this book first, you know. I agree with you that if you're going to be that person, you know, like JK is, then you take a lot of stuff from other people. You know, you carry a lot of stuff from other people. But I've seen him up and down the country do his speeches and talk to people and stuff like that. And, oh, God,
it's captivating.
It's life-changing, you know. Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, I'm really proud of him, you know. I'm really proud he's a good friend and just really proud of the impact he's had on New Zealand.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
You mentioned Kathy before, and you said you don't want to talk about that in too much detail. And I've noticed on your Instagram there's not a lot there about that as well. You just prefer to keep it private, or is it just too hard to talk about still?
I just... always been a big believer in my private life being private. You give that character that people watch and happy being that character and stuff like that. But you know, so what, when did I start on TV? 86, so it's a long time, and you just can't give them everything, you know. You've got to keep part of your life for you, and I've always felt that my family life is really mine for me. And yeah. You know, I was really, you know, when it was tough, I was, you know, I loved all the support we got from everyone, and people were amazing. But I've always been quite private. I'm just who I am. As I say, I play that role and do that stuff, but that sort of stuff's ready for me.
Yeah. Oh, I respect that fully. Coming from like a breakfast radio background, it's the same sort of thing. Like you're looking for personal content, because the more of that you give away, the more of a bond you form with the audience.
Yeah.
But, you know, me and JJ, we talked a lot when we were married about our fertility issues and stuff. And once you've given something away, you can't take it back.
It's tough, eh? I remember talking to, you know, advising people when they were looking at doing, you know, magazine stories and stuff about their relationships and stuff like that. It's like, oh, think twice about it, you know, because as you said, you know, once you give it to them, it's gone.
Yeah. Have you been in love since then, or have you seen anyone since then? Or
I've seen lots of people. I just walked down the road, there's like 30 people walking past me. Yeah, again, private life, you know. Okay.
I'm lucky, I guess. I'm 51 now, and yeah. I've never lost anyone. I've lost friends to cancer and suicide, unfortunately, but I've never lost... both my parents are still alive, and I've never lost anyone that's really close to me. But I'm probably projecting in that. I can't imagine like how difficult it is to start a new relationship and the guilt you feel, or even though it's what your former partner would want.
It's a tough. Really good try, but I'm not going to answer the question.
not trying at all.
No, it's a good point. But yeah, as I say, I mean...
Yeah.
I just like to keep something for me.
Yeah.
And that's my private life, you know. Like, you know, all my friendships a lot of them are with really high profile people, and like, you know, I mean, I don't think I've ever done an interview without talking about JK or Macca, or dropping Fitzy in there or whatever. And these are my friends, you know. So that part of my life is really public, you know. And there's part I just like to keep for me.
What about a book one day? A Rick Salezzo book. Like
every
question or topic that anyone throws at you, there's a good yarn behind it.
Yeah.
You thought about that? You've been offered?
I when I was in New York, I had Andy Ellis with me, he's a great bloke, and he was getting so sick of my stories. He was like, oh, man, don't give us another yarn of the All Blacks from the 89 tour or something like that. And then I had one of our players, Jace Emery, who's a New Zealand Māori player, came to my house. And then Andy popped in. And by the time Andy popped in, I had, you know, showing him Zinzan Brook videos and Good, the Bad and the Rugby and stuff like that. Poor old Jace was so... I don't know. I think, I mean, the thing is, I'm only halfway through, you know. Mm. So maybe at one stage. But you wouldn't want to write a book now and then do something great next week. So I think someone asked me, you know, you go back to that question at the top about what next. What I want to do next is I want to do something that's really, really great. You know, I just really want to, I don't know what it is, but I just want to keep getting better.
Mm.
I don't want to try and match what I've done before. I just want to do something better.
Mm. Oh, man, I love that attitude so much. Yeah, because I feel like a lot of people can think you're done, or think that you're over the apex, and that's it because you're in your 60s. But only you can determine that.
Yeah, could bring Sugar Shack back. Who knows?
learn from the mistakes time around. Oh, one thing I forgot. So, yeah, the Rugby World Cup last year, what was your involvement? You were like a content guy? No.
So, I spent all that time with Rugby New York, which, greatest city in the world. What an opportunity for me to live in New York and work. And I probably learned more about sports marketing and fan engagement and how to connect fans in 3 or 4 years there than I did in 30 years here. I mean, they're just incredible.
Yeah.
I was like taken to school every day. And the thing about New York too is if you don't bring your A game, you just get crushed. And so you've just got to have your A game all the time, even crossing the road. So I made the decision. So I did 4 seasons, one of whom got shut down because of COVID. And I made the decision at the beginning of last year that would be my last season. And then they reached out to me to see whether I'd make some content around the All Blacks for the World Cup. And initially I wasn't that keen because I was like, oh, I've sort of been there, done that. But then I was like, yeah, I wouldn't mind. I hadn't made content for a long time. And so I said to them, I said, who am I working with? And they said, well, we've only got one person so far, and it's Andy Ellis. I was like, oh, my God, I've just had him in living upstairs for 3 years or whatever, 2 years in New York. You know, it's like I've adopted him. But he's brilliant, so it was good to work with him. And then I brought in George Bauer, who was injured prop, you know, from the Crusaders and the All Blacks. And I didn't really know him, but I'd seen something on social that looked all right, and I thought I could work with him. And then Stacey Walker, who I'd always liked on TV, and a couple of others, LJ from Wales and Elmer from South Africa, and we did this thing called the Front Row Show. So we had to make, I think we made like 12 minutes a day for 55 days in a row or something.
Wow, that's a lot of content.
Yeah, it was a real challenge, but once I got into it, I really enjoyed it. It was just good to reconnect. Good way of me reconnecting with New Zealand again, even though I was in France. So it was good fun, and we did some good stuff.
Mm. Yeah, God, hell of a tournament too. Yeah. You must have been pleased when you were over there. Like with that, when was the Ireland game? Was that quarterfinal?
Can you believe it? I went to every game bar the Ireland game. I had COVID. Got up in the morning and I was like, of the Irish game. And I'm like, oh, I don't feel too well. I do a COVID test. And I'm like, no wonder I can't. So I spent that week in my room. But it was a good tournament. It's good. Mm. My favourite World Cup, I reckon, would be the 95 World Cup in South Africa. That was an incredible tournament. And I really liked, not sure why, but I really liked the 2015 tournament in England, in the UK. That we won. I thought that was a fantastic tournament.
Oh, Richie's last game.
Yeah, it was a really, really well run, good crowds, had a really good buzz about it. And the 87 World Cup was just brilliant. I mean, people forget that the first game, you know, when JK scored that try against Italy, I think there was like 17,000 people there. It was like a midweek game and it was raining and it was shitty and they did a little opening ceremony with Waka Nathan running out and cheerleaders slipping over in the rain and stuff like that. But it was really interesting to watch it unfold because the Six Nations didn't want a World Cup and they eventually got talked into it. So starting that, it was, you know, like starting the Sports Cafe. I mean, no one had a clue what it was going to look like, and it really built momentum during the World Cup. because of the way the All Blacks were playing, and there were some exciting games. So I enjoyed the 87 World Cup, but I was enjoying the last one until the last sort of 10 minutes.
Oh, it was good though. Any same as the other one we were talking about, the 95 one. Any final where it's a close game, I think that's all you can ask for, right?
Yeah. Well, you can ask for ones that you win. But they were good. No, I mean, I've always enjoyed New Zealand-South Africa clashes. So, yeah. Being old and being brought up on that stuff, been amazing. It was funny because I'm sitting in the stands watching the final, and there's these six South Africans, and you know, not quiet people when they're at a rugby game.
No, very passionate.
And I can't help myself, so I just drop in a little smart ass comment, and I thought they were going to kill me. And then I got half them on side against the other half. And then so we're talking at half time, and they're like, oh, we're such and such, and we play cricket and blah, 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 blah. And they're like, do you know Grant Elliott? And I'm like, yep. No, bullshit, you don't know Grant Elliott? And I said, I know Grant Elliott. Ring him. So they rang him on a video chat. Do you know this guy? Hey, it's Rick. That's New Zealand. We all know each other.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
So talking to Grant Elliott at halftime because they play cricket with him in South Africa.
Unreal.
Yeah.
Hey, that's been 90 minutes of your time. Do you enjoy doing things like this? You enjoy reflecting, or you're too busy looking forward to what's next?
No, I enjoy it. I, as I say, I'm really grateful. Because for everything I've done, someone's given me that opportunity, you know, whether it's the guys at Sky or, you know, Jeff with the book or, you know, someone said, you know, you can do this. Sometimes I've had to bash the door down a little bit, but and just be a bit pushy. I mean, when we did the Matthew Ridge documentary, the people at TVNZ didn't want it. And so I went to John McCready, who was running TV2, and he said, look, just make it on your credit card. I'll get it sorted while you're away. And so I came back, and they had like $50,000 on my credit card. And
my God.
They could have easily gone, no, we don't want it. But they said, yeah, and they cleaned my credit card. I didn't get paid a cent for it, but I got a clean credit card.
And this was like late 80s, so yeah, 50 grand is...
50 grand's a house. I'm just really grateful. I'm just really grateful that, people just believed in me enough to give me an opportunity to be creative. Mm. And you're the same. That's all you want. You just, when you're creative, you just want to be able to create, and someone's got to pay for it, and someone's got to put it on for an audience, you know. So, my job's to create, but someone else got to pay for it, and someone else got to put it on an audience. I mean, it's a bit different now. Like, you're doing this here, so I think that's really exciting. I think it's a really exciting move for people now, is that they can create their own shows. They're not stuck by going to have to pitch to a broadcaster, but it's more competitive than it's ever been. Like, so you're trying to get an audience on YouTube, where the greatest collection of content of all time lives. So so it's competitive, but if you can find your niche, it's just brilliant. It's what a great time to, you know, I mean, when we did Sports Cafe, I had to buy a studio, you know, when we did it at the bar, and it cost me $800,000-$900,000 to buy a studio. You know, and I just backed myself that we would stay on here long enough to pay it off. So it took about 5 years, 6 years to pay it off.
Oh my God!
But but now you know for a fraction of that, you know, you're able to put a show together. Mm. You know, and how exciting is that?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, no one knows where the future of media is going to go, but I just feel like it's going to be in micro audiences. So instead of having like a TV1, TV2, TV3 with big fat audiences, it's just going to be far more fragmented.
Yeah, and like having been there when it was easy, you know, where if you put something on TV1 and everyone watched it, to you know, making content for the All Blacks, where it's competitive, but you just need enough. I always think that when you make something, if three or four people tell you they love it, then you're onto something. Yeah, you can build from that.
Yeah, that's all you need, just that sniff of success. Yeah,
just three or four people, and not your family.
All right, Rick Salizzo, it's been, I feel like I know you particularly well from years and years of TV, but I do think this is the first time we've met, but I've thoroughly loved sitting down and picking your brains. It's been a real honour, and I can't thank you enough for the opportunity.
Oh, it's been fun, mate. I really enjoyed it. Nothing better than talking about myself.
No, I love your work, love the modesty, and I genuinely can't wait to see what you do next.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, good luck with the knee replacement.
All right, thanks, mate.
Salizzo on the Dom Harvey podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for making it all the way through. If you have any correspondence, constructive criticism, guest suggestions, feedback, maybe you just want to pay me some money, I don't know. Yes, sponsorship inquiries, anything like that, you can get hold of me, domharveynz@gmail.com or on Instagram, domharveynz. I used to be quite brittle when it came to criticism and feedback, even the constructive stuff, but now I understand how important it is, especially as I navigate my way through this new sort of media, the podcasting realm, where I have literally no idea what I'm doing. Just before we go, quick thanks to the sponsors who made this episode possible, Radix and Generate. Radix Nutrition and Generate KiwiSaver. Yeah, Generate is an award-winning KiwiSaver provider with a track record of chart-topping long-term performance. If you want to make sure you're making the most of your KiwiSaver account, chat to an advisor now. Head to generatekiwisaver.co.nz/get advice. Switching is real easy. You think it's going to be admin heavy? It isn't. I changed providers when Generate started supporting the podcast, and it could not have been easier. And if you do reach out to them, and I hope you do, please tell them that Dom sent you. That website again, generatekiwisaver.co.nz/get advice. Also, a huge thank to my day ones, the legends at Radix. Radix Nutrition is a Waikato-based company taking on the world. Elite athletes have been hammering their products since ages ago, but the truth is, each and every one of us can improve our health and therefore our life by eating more Radix products. Their range of freeze-dried breakfasts are impossibly good in terms of everything, really, the taste, the texture, simplicity, and the nutritional punch they pack. And I know I'm paid to say these things, but I genuinely do believe it. I use these products every day, and I reckon you should try them out as well. Their website, radixnutrition.co.nz. Radix is spelled R-A-D-I-X. radixnutrition.co.nz. Honestly, without the support of these businesses, the podcast week in, week out simply would not be possible. The guests as well for agreeing to come on, like Rick. I think that'll do us for this week. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you guys, and I do hope to see you next week on the Dom Harvey podcast. See ya.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.